Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Acil Ford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King Williams, Nanette Savard, Sonny Lasky, Dylan Lynch, M.B. Van Dorn, Thomas Penny, Tim Carlin, James Lewis, David Coyne, Casey Jones, and Mort Shelby. Deathlands number 27, Ground Zero. Ryan Carter looked back one last time. The gusting wind suddenly tugged back the white fog, like a curtain across a huge window, revealing the shore. There were the jumbled rocks. Trader and Abe, standing side by side, faced away from the ocean. Surrounding them was a menacing circle of men, looking, as far as Ryan could make out, like a mix of brushwood survivors and some capering scabbies. And at the front, leading them, was the unmistakable figure of Straub. There wasn't a thing that could be done. The companion's raft bobbed on the current.
No, traitor. Nothing's forever.
The fog was growing ever thicker, swirling around the waterlogged raft. The currents were so fast and treacherous that Ryan's big worry was trying to steer a course out to the island that hid the redoubt. The crossing was roughly 3/4 of a mile. If they missed the island, they could easily find themselves plowing remorselessly out into the Pacific Ocean. With the offshore drift and a vicious undertow, it could mean the end for all of them. J.B. Dix worked hard at the broken piece of wood that was his paddle.
More left!
The clumsy craft lurched from side to side, sometimes seeming as though it might have gone through a complete circle. Even Ryan was becoming confused. He was also finding it difficult to concentrate on reaching safety, part of his mind retaining that last image of Trader and Abe surrounded by what it looked like 15 or 20 enemies, including the dangerous and murderous stranger called Straub. Ryan had been reminded of a place he'd visited with Trader and the Warwags about 15 years earlier, up in Montana, not far from a ville called Billings. It had been the site of an old battlefield on slopes of sun-browned grass, above a winding river that the locals called the Little Bighorn. There had been a ruined building with a tumbled sign proclaiming that it had once been a visitor's center. Inside, there had been a damp-stained diorama of the climax of the fight, a blonde man with long hair and beard standing alone in a field of dead bluecoat soldiers, firing his revolver at circling hostile Native Americans. That was the image that kept returning to Ryan, burning into his brain with every stroke of his paddle. His 11-year-old son, Dean, was at his side, constantly turning to look behind them.
Think they'll be all right, Dad? Trader and Abe?
Of course. Trader could fall into a live volcano and come out complaining he was cold.
But I thought I saw...
Shut it, son. Just work on getting safely to that island.
The boy bit his lip and did what his father had told him. JB paused for a moment.
Dark night. The stink from those sulfur springs makes it hard going. Thought I heard an Armalite 3 or 4 minutes ago, and a big hand blaster. Sounded to me like Abe's 357 Colt Python, but the noise was flattened and distorted by the mist.
Ryan stopped paddling.
I'll tell you about it when we reach the island.
Christy Roth was kneeling waist deep in the cold gray water on his other side. Her bright red hair was dulled, coiled tight around her nape. She rubbed at her hands, peering down at incipient blisters, had managed to smile at Ryan, her deep emerald eyes the brightest thing to be seen.
Felt trouble, soon as Trader pushed off and wouldn't join us on the raft. Figures good old Abe would go with him.
You feel anything now? Living or dying?
No, Ryan. You saw them?
Yeah, and some brushwooders and scabbies.
Bad news.
Worst to come. Straub was there. I spotted his shaved head. Think they might have bought the farm back there.
Nothing we could have done, Mother.
I know that, Christy. My head tells me that. My heart tells me about those years JB and me rode with him.
The tide had the last word. I got the feeling we're not far from the redoubt now.
Now let's go for it.
Resuming paddling caused Ryan a lot of serious pain. He'd been wounded with an arrow through the lower back. The shaft had been withdrawn, but there'd been no time to rest. He was aware that he'd lost a fair amount of blood. JB had taken a musket ball through the fleshy part of his upper left arm in the same firefight. He was doing an impressive job working his paddle right-handed. He'd taken off his glasses to protect them from the ceaseless spray, putting them safely in one of his capacious pockets. His battered fedora was pulled down over his forehead. Jack Lauren had also been wounded, his right calf peppered with jagged splinters of rock from a near miss. But the albino teenager was as blank-faced as ever, sitting astride one of the longer logs that made up the raft, his stark white hair pasted flat to his angular skull, his red eyes smoldering like backlit rubies. Every now and again, Jack would stop rowing and look carefully around him for any sign of hostile life beneath the heaving waters. The other two people battling the ocean sat close together near what served as the bow of the raft. One was a stockily built black woman in her middle 30s, working away at her paddle with determination, the beads in her plaited hair swaying with every stroke. Dr. Mildred Wyeth had been born a week before Christmas in 1964. On December 28th in the year 2000, in her hometown of Lincoln, Nebraska, Mildred had undergone a surgical procedure for a suspected minor abdominal problem. Things had gone wrong, and she had been taken unconscious from the operating room to be medically frozen. Cryogenics, ironically, was her own particular specialty. She'd slept on, untouched, during the horrific nuclear holocaust that had wiped out 99/100 of the world's population. The strike and counterstrike from both sides of the political walls had begun only 3 weeks after she had been hermetically sealed into her capsule. Nearly 100 years had passed before Ryan and his companions came along and revived her. Mildred's story was truly amazing, but the life of the tall, gray-haired man paddling hard next to her, his antiquated frock coat blackened with seawater, was even more astounding. Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner, answering most commonly to plain old Doc, had earned a science degree from Harvard, then the doctorate of philosophy from Oxford University in England. Doc had been born in the beautiful hamlet of South Stratford, Vermont, on a cold and snowy St. Valentine's Day in 1868, which, by one way of counting, made him somewhere around 200 years and a few decades old. He'd married Emily Chandler in June of 1891. There had been two children, Rachel and little Julian, and 5.5 years of transcendental happiness for the family, with a future as bright as a newly minted silver dollar. But then, a time-trolling experiment wrenched him from everything near and dear. He became a victim of Operation Kronos, devised by men of science, with no thought for human consequences.
Rocks ahead. I hear them. A bit to the right.
Jack pointed with his bleached, long-fingered hand. Those on the left of the raft paddled a little harder, while the others rested, feeling the tangled bulk of ill-matched wood swing ponderously in the right direction. Ryan risked standing and saw a jagged crest of rock a couple of hundred feet above the low-lying fog. On impulse, he glanced behind him. All he could see was a solid wall of gray-white fog, the stink of sulfur filling his nostrils. There was no going back.
Oh, shit.
Boy, whoa! Kennedy's!
Watch out for crabs!
They scrambled wetly and safely into 18 inches of water and walked up onto dry rock. Above them, black-headed gulls dove at the seven invaders.
Might as well get straight to the redoubt. No point waiting around here, getting colder.